As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZSC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSC staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726 or by email at prc@kzsc.org. Welcome to the Pandemoscene podcast, where we attempt to create knowledge that orients us towards justice at this critical historical juncture. Today, we will be talking about state-sponsored misinformation during the COVID-19 pandemic. What role does technology play in spreading or curbing disinformation? How can private media companies be held accountable, and what can we as individuals do to respond to misinformation? Stay tuned to the Pandemoscene podcast as we search for answers to these questions.
Do you think Twitter is limited in its ability as a platform for nuanced discussion? And is it possible to move past, you know, like the echo chamber and promote ideas to a larger audience?
When it comes to activism online, and I engage quite a few activists over the course of my day and all different forms of social media, what's difficult is the kinds of activism around platforms in 2011, 2012, the things that we think about when we talk about the potential for Twitter or Facebook to bring about some kind of liberatory democracy, we think about those movements. But those were early adopters. Those were people who came in and really showed what the system was capable of. And then we've seen this time and time again, where if it's a successful strategy for getting out the word or a call to action, marketers then come in and they're like, yes, we want to convert. And what we want to convert people to is consumers. And so if this style of messaging and this kind of urgency works here, then it should work to sell our products. And you see sort of last on the list, but probably people that should have been attuned to this much earlier, politicians coming in and trying to figure out, well, how do I use this strategy to gain momentum and mobilize people? But in the interim of that moment of marketers figuring out that social media is good for product, is that Facebook and Twitter designed advertising systems that really mimicked a lot of the ways in which movements had originally figured out how to galvanize their networks. And so Facebook in particular thought about their advertising model, and then it allows you to create all these custom lists and target people based on very finite, fine-grained information about where they live and, you know, where they shop and what other kinds of things they like and what their political affiliation is, and all of these different ways in which you can start to section off audiences. And by doing that, by creating an advertising system that acts like mimics the kind of work that activists had taken a long time to do, which is to build these networks, really gave an advantage in 2016 to media manipulators who didn't have to build audiences, they could just buy them. And so now we're in a situation where I think people really long for and have like this kind of techno nostalgia about the potential for social media to liberate us all, when in fact it's been completely commodified in a way that is, it's almost difficult to even see it when it's happening, but all of your social networks have been sold in these ways. And so, and the last thing I'll say is about the infrastructure of the system, which is to say that as we moved into this moment that moved away from social networking and into social media with this built-in advertising, you get different political actors, you get different political effects. And infrastructurally, though, it doesn't look that different to you. So your feed is still your feed, you're still scrolling through things. And the only thing they've added is this tiny little, you know, marker that says the post was sponsored. and it's in gray and it's easy to miss. You know, so there's a lot that's gone on, but I should say that the issue with activism now is that activists still need to do that groundwork, still need to make those connections, are not invested in just purchasing audiences. But for some politicians, this has been a big boon.
Like, on this note, you do talk about the responsibility that social media platforms have, like Facebook and Twitter, to flatten the misinformation curve. But can there be a grassroots response to the infodemic, and how would that look like?
Yeah, I think that there is already a grassroots response. It's a good question. I think that journalists, especially the ones that I know from NBC News, are on point. They are doing everything they can to surface mutual aid networks, to look to community organizations that are already doing the service work. One of the very first webinars that we did was with April Glazier, who had been writing about the different mutual aid networks that were popping up in different cities. And I know that I have incredible friends and colleagues at UCLA, for instance, that just did a, you know, started informally on Instagram saying, we're healthy, we're willing to go to the store for you, you don't have to use any of these grocery shopping services. We are also collecting donations of things and we'll bring them to you, or, you know, Pampers and baby formula, things like that. And so they already knew already that they were going to have to take care of one another. And that network started to grow and become more formalized. And now they've got a separate Instagram account that allows them to take in requests and then also process them through a volunteer. I almost used the term Rolodex, which I realize nobody's even going to know what that is, but they have like a volunteer network that they can, you know, start to parse the requests with. And we saw similarly, like in the aftermath of the Hurricane Sandy, a kind of mutual aid network get built up very fast, using online media and then also the volunteer labor of people who are willing to do what's called the last mile work. And I think that that's where we are right now, is we've got a deficit with the last mile, especially when it comes to information, which is we need timely, local, and relevant information. It needs to be redundant. That's what's important here about platforms, is that you have to say, you have to see it everywhere to, you know, make it stick. But the last mile of information in an infodemic looks like grassroots organizations reminding people what the symptoms of COVID-19 are, where to get a test, and how this might be free to you, or how to get access to other financial services in the wake of the pandemic. And so I think that there's a lot of room for mutual aid networks as well as social justice organizations to be those credible sources of information, as long as they remember that the point is redundancy. You want people to see the same information every day so that they feel comforted by the fact that some things are not changing, or services are expanding. But platforms on the other side of this tend to make everything national or global. They really don't help you get at those local networks and that local last mile of information. It can become really hard to find that. And so we often recommend people go to, if their city or the local town has a website with that information on it, to check it early and often, and to let people know if that has changed in your city, any of the information that they might need to know. And so people can act as sort of their own amplifiers in this moment. And I think that it's important to think about social media as still being participatory, but in a different way, right? The point of this being, remember that you live in a community, remember that people are relying on you, and that when you post things that are panic inducing, you can increase social isolation and depression amongst people in your network. So it's really important to be credible, and also, you know, someone to be looked too, as a force for good in this moment.
Early voting has started in California and will be available until November 2nd. Voters can vote early either in person or by dropping off a ballot in a county drop box. Ballot drop-off locations and early voting information are available at caearlyvoting.sos.gov. Tune in to Now, Hear, This, and explore health and safety topics with the aim of raising awareness and celebrating a mindful contemplation of the mundane. A carefully curated journey through the soundscape of public service announcements, educational materials, and a dash of music representing a different theme each Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. on 88.1 FM.
An informed public is critical to fighting a pandemic. Regrettably, numerous sources of misinformation have garnered credibility among segments of the population. How can we engage and create forms of technology that can identify and arrest the circulation of misinformation? And what can be done to combat the weaponization of technology for the propagation of deceptive and exploitative messages?
It's hard because it's not a technical fix. Unfortunately, it's a socio-technical problem that spans human behavior, and the technical systems can be very different depending upon where you go for information and how you selectively shape your own media diet. And I'll say this because I think that it's important that people start to look to other places than social media for information. I think local TV news, my wife and I, 6 o'clock, it's pretty much the only news that we've been watching is we'll watch half an hour of the local news. It's going to tell me what's happening at the hospital. It's going to tell me what's happening in Boston area. It's going to tell me what stores are open and which ones are closed. It's going to give me what I need to know to live in the area that I'm living in and how to protect myself. And I think that local TV and local radio in some places are doing a really good job, and we're forgetting about those channels first and foremost. And I think that that's worth mentioning. And then when it comes to the weaponization question, one of the things that's come up, and I think that, your center is going to have to deal with this for years to come, which is how do we as a community deal with bad science, right? So right now, some of the worst things that have happened related to health misinformation are coming from places that we would otherwise trust. There was a researcher at Stanford that said California must have had herd immunity, and the media ran with that, and that was too much. California doesn't have herd immunity. There's lots of exceptions to California, but this ain't it. Right. There was another one with a Stanford study that had said that the proportion was of people that are asymptomatic with COVID is much higher than we had anticipated, which means the death count is actually much lower. This study was funded by a airline executive in part. And so right now there are business interests involved in funding speculative studies that are then, once they go into preprint, are being treated as if they were peer reviewed and fact checked and have all of the importance of studies that usually take 2 years to come out. So when it comes to science and how it might show up in health misinformation, how it might become politicized, where we would seek justice in those moments, I don't always know. But what I do know at this point is that science is becoming, at least the science on COVID-19, is becoming a political arena. And even if your study is well done, has great methods, has been peer reviewed, it still might not have large generalizable findings. But once the media takes a turn with it, politicians take a turn with it, you go from the death count might not be as high in proportion as we thought to the population to very quickly to reopen, the risk is much lower than we thought, right? And those are two very different kinds of findings and two very different ways of framing this. But when it comes to science and justice, I think that a big part of this is going to be figuring out where we put up some boundaries and where as a community of scholars, we try to hold each other accountable. While at the same time realizing that, you know, sometimes you do an experiment, you get some results and they just are what they are. And maybe they're not entirely conclusive. Maybe they are speculative, but once it breaks out of the arena where everybody sort of knows the rules and the limitations, that's when you get into the hyperbole and you know, the real politicization of science, which is something that can kill. You know, we know that. And we saw this weekend lots of contradictory information about mask wearing and social distancing. We are going to know in 2 weeks what that looks like in different areas hit a second wave of COVID infections.
And as far as tech solutions go, I was curious to hear your thoughts on how Apple and Google are working together to create digital contact tracing, or as they're calling it, exposure notifications. I was wondering your thoughts on, like, you know, the line between, like, a public life and private health, private life and public health, and your thoughts on privacy of that.
Yeah, so I've been following very closely the work of Mary Gray and her colleagues on this, thinking through her framework. So she wrote this with her co-author, this book called Ghost Work, about essentially the forms of labor that get hidden within technical systems. And so Uber is not just an app, it is like an entire organization, it's a firm that has, you know, thousands of employees, and every time they try to hide the human in the loop, you know, her research really exposes that you devalue labor and you make it seem the system seem a lot more simple than it is. Contact tracing is another one where technology isn't going to be effective without humans who can explain to you what it means to be exposed and what your risk is and can talk you through where it might have happened. And it reminds me a little bit of when people had started to get DNA ancestry test information and they wanted to know more about, well, what does this mean if I have a risk factor? Mm-hmm. Right. And so you see this entire industry of genetic counseling start to develop around this this technology. And I think that with contact tracing, we can learn from that field and from that development to know that these things, if they're deployed at scale without a robust infrastructure for talking to people about what you're getting notified about, is going to be a huge disaster. It's going to be really devastating for the public health of people. And then we also know the other part of this, which is that to have been in the same place as someone doesn't necessarily automatically lead to, you know, infection. There's going to be a lot of questioning. There's going to be, again, another round of skepticism and inquiry that we need to be ready for, and we need to be prepared for, and we need to be able to answer people's questions. But Apple and Google in particular set up tech systems that are non-responsive.
Can I just say, ask one thing on that? And I resonate a lot of what you were saying. But the other big thing hanging over a lot of people is this whole thing with Trump. And so you started with this about Twitter and Trump. Maybe we can find this. You'll be writing about this. But I wonder if, do you see this as a moment where anything's going to shift at all? Like, are there, does the pandemic bring possibilities for hope in that sense of breaking what we've seen as longstanding entrenched political problems?
Yeah, I think that what you're seeing with Twitter putting a fact check on one of Trump's tweets is the expansion of Twitter's belief in its own capacity to withstand political pressure, right? And that Twitter now realizes that they have the power, not him. And he is a power user. Of course, there is very mixed feelings about what Twitter would be like without Trump at this stage, because he's so much of the focus and the gravitational pull for some. But in doing so, I think them placing the fact check on those mail-in ballots was an important measure, because what they realized is their terms of service actually couldn't get at the kind of harassment that the widower has been facing since Trump has brought up that that controversy about one of his most hated media figures, Joe Scarborough. And so Twitter had to realize very quickly that by having Trump on the platform, he's causing a lot of pain and anguish for this family. But they couldn't get him on that. Right. And they were being called out by anyone and everyone in that moment. And then we're like, well, if we are going to apply any of our rules at this stage, we're very confident that this one about the mail-in ballots is important to do. And I'll say that it's important to do because a while ago they announced these policies and said, we are not going to let disinformation affect voting outcomes or the voting process. And so they are paying very close attention to anything that has to do with misrepresentations of trust in elections and in the election process. It's advantageous, of course, for the incumbent to say that voting is fraudulent in any kind of way, because that leaves them in the standing of being able to say, I lost, but I don't have to leave. Right. Or, and for a while, a month ago, I was questioning, are we even going to have an election? Like, what is this going to look like? And so I think that Twitter taking a moment in this, really scary situation, I think, because if Trump does start to attack Twitter, then we're going to see a whole bunch of other changes get implemented very quickly across all these other platforms, because they're going to try to keep the heat on Twitter and keep it off of them. And so it might mean that there's much more election misinformation on other platforms because they're not moderating. At the same time, if Twitter becomes the fall guy for election tampering or election misinformation, then, journalism is going to be imperiled, because most journalists at this stage are distributing their content through Twitter. And so today is a big day of reckoning, thinking through like what that's going to look like. And the first signs of the problem that I'll wrap up on that I'm seeing is that people who work for Twitter are now being harassed by right-wing, folks on Twitter, from everything from YouTube stars to Fox News hosts and things. So we are in a moment where Twitter is going to feel the full force of the conservative media ecosystem, and they're going to realize very quickly what activists and journalists have been saying for some time, which is it's painful to be on this platform and it's scary. And they're going to see that. And so I'm hoping, obviously, for some kind of support for the people who work at Twitter so that they don't end up, part of this cancel culture, but at the same time, I don't think you take on Trump and walk away unscathed.
Professor Donovan has given us so much to think about and has left us with even more questions and leads to explore. What openings for organizing towards social justice still exist on social media networks? Are large platforms such as Twitter and Facebook even useful anymore, if they ever were, for community organizing and building mutual aid networks? What alternatives exist or can be imagined and built that would better serve these purposes? And what can each of us, regardless of our background or profession, do to help curb and combat deadly misinformation in our social networks, both virtual and in flesh and blood? With the election so soon, thinking about these questions is a large task, but a vital one. As we continue to grapple with Trump's and other politicians' uses of these large platforms to deliberately spread misinformation, the science on COVID-19 has so visibly become a political arena, and the actions that we each take will matter, shaping life, health, and death differently for each of our communities. And with that, we would like to thank you for tuning in. Tune back in next week for another angle on the COVID-19 pandemic from the Pandemicene podcast.